Ready. Our guest presenter at today's session of the Futures Forum is Charles Brass. Charles was a leading founder of the Future of Work Foundation 25 years ago with the intention of creating a better future for all Australians at work. Since then, his work and his writing have taken him all over the world, and he has been a regular commentator in the media. For over a decade, he has nurtured the development of the Futures Foundation, whose mission is to engage all Australians in creating a better future. Charles' topic today is the role of jobs and employment in creating Australia's future. Charles, what do you have to tell us about the future of jobs?
Well, Jim, I guess the first place to begin is to say that there better be a future for employment and jobs in our economy, because they're so essential to the way we think our economy functions. I mean, our whole economy is predicated on the assumption that a significant majority of adults will have a job through which they do the stuff and produce the stuff that the economy needs, and out of which they get enough income to provide for themselves and the rest of their life. And that's so central to the way in which we operate that if that is under any threat, there are some questions to be asked. And that's really what I want to do today, is to ask the question, how stable, how reliable, how confident can we be that that model of operating is likely to continue in the future? This is what futurists do. One of the reasons futurists exist is because they encourage people to ask questions that are otherwise taken for granted. We take this economic model for granted. You only have to look at the amount of money governments put into supporting jobs wherever they can. Look at every single political party says, vote for me, I'll create more jobs. This whole mantra is based around the notion that the economy is such an incredibly important fundamental way of operating, and we take it for granted. So the question is there a future for jobs? Is there a future? And then the first question to ask was, is there any reason to ask this question? Well, I would say yes. There's a number of reasons to ask this question. You see headlines all over the place in the press about employers shedding jobs all over the place. We've got the car industry coming to an end in Australia. There are all sorts of other industries that are disappearing. And we see large numbers of jobs disappearing in headlines. We also see headlines in other places suggesting that young people are unable to find jobs all around the world for one reason or another. So you'd have to say, on the basis of that sort of press coverage, there's at least a reason to ask whether this is how stable this way of operating is. Asking this question has quite actually a long and undistinguished history. For many people, it began with a man called Ned Ludd in England in the early 1800s. The early 1800s were characterised by the rise of the Industrial Revolution. And really what happened in that process was a whole lot of lives that had been very stably operating for many, many centuries were suddenly challenged. They were challenged essentially by equipment and machinery. And people like Ned Ludd, that's where the phrase Luddite comes from, were people who tried to smash that machinery. Now, it was very quickly discovered that, in fact, what that machinery was doing, yes, it was disrupting lives, but it was, in fact, creating new lives for a whole raft of people. And for the first 100 years or so of the Industrial Revolution, many of those jobs, and that's where the word comes from, it's about that time, many of those jobs were not particularly satisfying for people, and they were dangerous and dirty and expensive and lengthy and stuff like that. But nonetheless, there is no question that the Industrial Revolution raised the living standards of a whole raft of people and created a new form of jobs and employment for people. And so that sort of Luddite question of is this doing us damage was very quickly displaced. Since then, the question's been asked on a number of occasions by a number of people, and by and large, people have come to pretty much the same conclusion. People point to statistics like the number of people employed in Australia in agricultural industries at the turn of the 20th century was over 25%, was over a quarter. the number of people employed in agriculture. By agriculture, I don't just mean farming. I mean everything to do with growing, transporting, distributing food. At the turn of the 21st century, it was about 3%. They also point out that in manufacturing industry, the percentage of people employed in manufacturing at the turn of the 20th century was about the same as the number of people employed in manufacturing at the turn of the 21st century in Australia, having gone through a huge hump in the middle. And then as soon as they point out those statistics, someone points out the huge rise in what's called service industries and how much employment's been created in those sorts of industries. So by and large, history has suggested that as things have changed, people have been very concerned about whether or not their jobs are at threat. But by and large, history has suggested that every time something's come along to disrupt things, something else has come along to replace it, and we've been largely better off. And you can see that even in today's environment, people read headlines about loss of jobs and fear about manufacturing disappearing and stuff like that. And respected economists like Ross Gittins earlier in the Age earlier this year produce articles with a headline that says, don't worry, the jobs will be there as they always have been there, because what's happening is we're just changing one thing for another. And if you listen to our federal government, they say pretty much the same thing. You know, they say, yes, we've got a problem with certain classes of jobs at the moment, but if only people will get their skills right, or if only entrepreneurs will become cleverer or something like that, we'll create all the jobs that we need to create and everything will be fine. It's a long history of asking the question, and you've got evidence on both sides. We've got headlines suggesting that perhaps it's disappearing. We've got other people saying it's just a temporary thing and it'll change. The most in Australia, we have perhaps one of the oldest statesmen futurists in Australia is a guy called Phil Riven, who runs IBIS Business Services. And he, a number of years ago, addressed this question and said that the world had been through a number of revolutions. I've already mentioned the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, and he said we're now in what he called the infotronics revolution. But what he said characterised each of those revolutions was that human beings outsourced stuff that they once did for themselves. So if you think about the old feudal days, you and your immediate family grew and made pretty well everything that you needed. And what's happened steadily over time is that people grow and make and do much less for themselves. Instead, they outsource it to someone else in exchange for money, and then they buy the services that they want. And Phil Riven points out that there's still something around 40% of what we do in the world that we do for ourselves. And so he argues there's plenty of space to outsource that, and the economy can keep on going and growing. So he certainly would be one of many people who would say, well, there's no real reason to ask this question because there's plenty of evidence to suggest we're heading in the right direction. What about the counter-argument? Well, is the counter-argument would have to say, is this time, is there any reason to believe this time's any different to any others? Any reason to believe that the sorts of trends we're seeing and the sorts of headlines we're seeing are more likely to be evidence of a declining trend, or are they just a dip that's going to be replaced? Well, on that front, you'd have to notice that one of the most significant features of the 21st century is that we now need human beings to do much less of the work that we actually do. If you think back to the Industrial Revolution, what happened there was we learnt how to harness huge amounts of power, and we learnt how to apply that power in all sorts of ways. But it was very crude power. It was basically heat up a lot of water and create a lot of steam and then apply that steam. It's a pretty large scale, very crude thing. Over the last couple of hundred years, we've become much more sophisticated in the use of that power and much more sophisticated in the tools that we use. And at the present moment, what we have gradually seen is human beings doing less and less of the stuff that human beings once did. In part, that's been because a lot of what human beings used to do was dangerous and dirty, and we didn't want them to do it. So we've got rid of as much of that as we possibly can. But steadily, we are replacing things We're getting non-humans to do things that human beings did. So you start to see articles in newspaper stories talking about robots replacing humans, talking about the wide variety of ways in which our non-human intelligence is now engaged in jobs and of all kinds, from base level physical jobs to quite high level, quite sophisticated, what we might have once thought intellectual jobs. You can now get a computer that is better at reading an X-ray than a human doctor. The artificial neural intelligence reads X-rays better than many doctors. You find people like the ex-Vice President of the United States, who recently wrote a book called The Future, suggesting that this trend is now nearing a threshold beyond which so many jobs are lost that the level of consumer demand falls below the level necessary to sustain economic development. So he's suggesting that while perhaps some jobs are continuing to be generated, enough jobs are being lost that in fact the whole economy is threatened. This has a quite interesting history. In fact, in the late 1800s, a man called Andrew Urey, for those who know the history of manufacturing, one of the early manufacturing barons, actually wrote a book on this subject, and he anticipated that the world would eventually reach a point at which human labour was not needed because manufacturing would take it over. And in fact, at that time, this was quite a tradition at those times, that people like William Morris in England and Edward Bellamy in America, most of them we would consider socialists today, were actively looking forward to the day when human beings didn't have to go down mines and didn't have to do things, so we would be liberated to do all the wonderful, exciting things that we would like to do. So there is some evidence to suggest that these trends are not just a blip, but they have a deeper fundamental evidence of a trend. And I want to add a couple of statistics to this. First, I want to notice, what do we ask business owners to do? What is the fundamental imperative that we expect of a business owner? And that is to drive down their costs so they can increase their profit. And it's arguable that if business owners don't do that, they're breaking the law, because that's the obligation to their business. If we reach a point where it is cheaper for business owners to use machines or to use artificial intelligence, do we expect them to not do that? And if we do expect them to not do that, why do we expect them to not do that? Because it's cheaper. The expectation is that their job is to produce things at the lowest possible cost. If we are developing technology to the extent where it is capable of replacing human beings, what do we expect our business owners to do? I'd also want to point out what I think is a quite damning statistic, although other people interpret it differently. If you go back to the Bureau of Statistics figures for 1964, and the Bureau of Statistics does an annual State of the Nation report, if you go back to 1964, 93% of all jobs in Australia were full-time jobs. If you go forward to 1984, that was 75%. If you go forward to 2014, it's 67%. There is a 50-year trend of the number of full-time jobs as a percentage of the jobs in the country just steadily disappearing. Now, as I've said, some people think that's a good thing. Many women, for example, think that's a really good thing because women are overrepresented in what is called part-time work, and it has been the introduction of part-time work that's made it more possible for women to go to work. They've been able to juggle their so-called work-family responsibilities more easily because there's part-time work available. It's also been a boon for employers, because where in 1964 an employer was responsible for finding work for an employee in a full-time sense, in 2014, if the employer doesn't have work for the employee, they just send the employee home, they don't pay them. So from an employer point of view, this rise of part-time work has been a boon. And certainly if you look at the percentage of the population who is engaged in employment from 1964 to 2014, it's about the same. Roughly the same percentage of the population are involved. But what's changed profoundly is that a much smaller percentage of those are engaged in full-time jobs. Now, why does that matter? Well, in part that matters because, remember, the idea of the jobs economy is that a job is not just to get done what needs doing, it's also to provide you the income necessary to live the rest of your life. And this is where the part-time, the increase of part-time work has a more problematic dimension. You don't get paid as much for doing a part-time job as you do for doing a full-time job. So one of the questions you might ask as this has increased is, what has this increase in part-time meant for the capacity of people to provide for themselves in the world? There's a second fact which always amuses me, because I started this by saying politicians are always about creating jobs. Yes, they are. We need to look at what the definition of a job is. What does it mean to have a job? And we live in a very increasingly global world nowadays, and so we have international definitions for these things. So the international definition, from a statistical point of view, of a job is that a person has a job if they worked for money for more than 2 hours in the last fortnight. So every single person who worked for pay for more than 2 hours in the fortnight has a job. And that is counted with exactly the same degree of substance as a person who had a 40-hour job last week. So when a politician says there are, you know, 11 million jobs in Australia, it's not quite that, but 7 million jobs in Australia, that includes those people who are working 2 hours a week and those people who are working. So statisticians recognise this, and so when you ask the Bureau of Statistics to look at this in more detail, they actually come up with a very complicated way of measuring who has a job and who doesn't have a job. And without going into too much detail, I will say at this point, I've produced a paper which I'm happy to distribute to anybody who asks, which has all these statistics in and references to all these things. But basically, if you look at the facts and figures, according to the official statistics, Australia has an unemployment rate of about 6% at the moment. The implication behind that is that about 6% of the population are looking for work. In fact, the percentage of people who say, if you ask the Bureau of Statistics, would you like a job, and don't have one, is nearly 20%. The reason for the difference between those two is because there are a whole bunch of people who aren't prepared to jump through the hoops that you need to be defined as unemployed. In order to be defined as unemployed, you've got to be registered by the government, you've got to be looking for a job and all those things. Lots of people disappear in the system. So lots of people suggest that we have what some commentators call a hidden army of unemployed, who are people who are not on the official statistics, but who are in fact finding it difficult to make their way in the world. So I would say, just on the basis of that, it's worth asking the question, what's the future for jobs and employment? There's a lot of debate to be had about which way it goes, but let's ask the question, at least. And I have to say, we've been asking, Jim said in the introduction, the Future of Work Foundation's been around for 25 years. We've been asking this question for 25 years, and we came up with some thoughts about the changing world of work 25 years ago. Plenty of people were asking the same questions and thinking about the same things. Over the course of the last 25 years, however, an increasing number of people have started to suggest that perhaps the downside of these things I've talked about are not just a blip, but are worth looking at in more detail. So let me then say, okay, let's say the question's worth asking, and let's say that there is no future for jobs and employment. What does that mean? What would that mean? Well, the first thing it means is that clearly all jobs are not going to disappear. There is always going to be work that needs doing, and there's always going to be an economy of some kind that we need to operate in. But the question really becomes, to go back to Al Gore's quote earlier, what if an insufficient number of people are able to participate in the economy? We already have in this country about 5 million people who rely for their income on government benefits, and we've all just experienced a federal budget in which the Treasurer went to great pains to say the age of entitlement is over. So I think it's fair to say the government believes at least that we've got too many already who are on this system. So 5 million is somewhere around the cusp of a dangerous number as far as our government is concerned. What would it mean if there were a larger number? And why does that matter? Well, the example that I like, and it comes from Al Gore's example, is imagine that you're a salesman charged with selling mobile phones, and you have to sell, pick a number, 500 mobile phones a week. It's no use going to Warren Buffett and asking him, because Warren Buffett is not going to buy 500 mobile phones no matter how many times you ask him. He's certainly got the financial wherewithal to buy 500 mobile phones, but he's not going to buy them. He doesn't want them. He doesn't need them. If you are in the business of selling mobile phones, you need at least 500 people with the capacity to buy your mobile phone. You need them to be there on a weekly basis. This is why this question matters. So, all right, the question matters. What might it mean? Well, there have been a variety of solutions proposed. All sorts of suggestions have been proposed. One answer is to redistribute the available work in a more equitable way. So at the moment we have a number of people who have a lot of work, and we talk about people who are overworked. We don't really keep very good statistics on working hours in Australia anymore, because we abandoned our centralised industrial relations system where overtime was formally recorded in employer payrolls. Nowadays you have to ask people how many hours they worked last week, and that's a little more difficult to tell, but there clearly are a number of people who are overworked, and we hear about people who are too busy and all those sorts of things. So there exists in the world a quite profound shorter time working network, which has been advocating for a number of years to try and shift things around so that more people get, those people who don't have enough work get a bit, those who have too much lose a bit. It's not just web-based shorter working type networks. In the 1990s, the French government was that concerned about this. They actually passed a law that mandated a maximum of 35 hours a week. And they actually sent police onto the roads of France looking for lights in buildings. And if your light was on in the building, an inspector could come in and check whether the people in the building were working more than 35 hours a week, and they would be penalised and technically thrown in jail. Didn't last very long. They abandoned that very quickly. The Canadian government, at about the same time, they came up with a scheme where they taxed, they put 150% tax on overtime. 150% tax on overtime. So clearly there was a huge disincentive to work overtime. And then they instructed their tax officials to try and work out, on the basis of people's salary, how much work, how many hours overtime they'd worked, and then try and work out how much to tax them. That didn't last very long either. But it was an attempt to deal with this question. In the global financial crisis, the Germans came up with a scheme they called Kurzarbeit, short work. And what the German government said to industry in Germany at the time of the financial crisis was, please don't sack everybody. That causes too much disruption in our system. If you, instead of sacking someone, will reduce their working hours, we, the government, will top it up so that they will get back to what they were earning full-time, but they'll get a sort of government payment. So there have been various efforts and attempts via that mechanism, and various other people have made suggestions for tweaking the tax system in some way. The German government, I mentioned, it's been suggested that there should be a greater tax on high wage earners. There should be, some people have, one author suggested that payroll tax, you ought to be able to claim less of your managing director's salary as a tax benefit and more of your lower workers' salary as a tax benefit in payroll tax. So at the moment, if you pay your managing director $20 million a year, you can claim all of that as a tax deduction, same as if you pay an office worker $20,000. So there are all sorts of suggestions for tweaking tax deductions, finding new ways to shift the money around. That's one suggestion that's been made. I've got to move on. I could spend time on lots of these. This has led some people to go a stage further and to suggest, okay, we need to think again about the way our society is structured, and to suggest that what should happen is that instead of this current system where if you fall out of the employment system, you get some sort of a government benefit, what the government should do is provide what's called a guaranteed minimum income. And so what the government does is, out of its taxation, it provides everybody in the country with a minimum amount, and you can then top that up with whatever employment you want to make. And you can think about how much tax you need to collect to do that. But the idea then is that what the society does is it says our productive capacity should be distributed to everybody in society, and it does that through this guaranteed minimum income scheme. Interestingly, we in this country have what we call a sovereign wealth fund, which was set up a number of years ago, which is designed to provide for the future. Many countries now have sovereign wealth funds. The Alaskan Sovereign Wealth Fund is one of many around the world. What it does with its sovereign wealth fund is it actually distributes an income to every single Alaskan every year out of the sovereign wealth fund. What happens in Australia is the interest just gets paid back to the federal government and they spend it any way they like. So in Alaska last year, a family of four got about $7,000 out of the wealth fund, a sort of guaranteed minimum income, a new way of thinking about how you might engage with the world. So there's some ways in which the money system might be tweaked if this was a problem. What are some other things that you might do if this really is a problem? Well, one thing you might do is increase the way individuals have access to the means of production. We're already seeing a whole lot of what you might call self-help movements of various kinds. Grow your own veggies so you don't have to buy them at the supermarket. Make your own clothes, recycle clothes, get into swap clubs so you recycle, those sorts of things. This sort of self-help movement is another way of taking people outside this sort of economic system that relies on them having an income from a job and gives them another way to get there. You can extend that to employee ownership of the companies that they work for, and there are all sorts of organisations in various parts of the world that have large employee ownership systems and schemes. One of the largest is a Spanish company called the Mondragon Cooperatives, which is in fact about 700 companies, have a turnover about $13 billion a year, and they are entirely owned by their employees. And one of the things that researchers have discovered is that if employees have a greater sense of ownership of their workplace, those companies are less likely to sack people and more likely to think differently. Mondragon has, for example, an inviolate rule about the gap between the largest salary in the Mondragon cooperative and the lowest salary. It's now about 9 times. We've got American companies where it's 250 times a gap. So there are those sorts of things. So you can give people ownership of the means of production. Some people have even gone further than that and suggested if robots are going to take over, well, why don't we let them take over? And when you're born, you get given your own robot and you earn the income that they earn. So that you don't actually have to go to work, and then you can, you know, buy, swap, share, whatever you want to do with your robots, and they make it all, and we just don't go to work. We have our income. Let the robots do it all. All of those seem to me to be useful ideas, and what I'm trying to do is to stimulate some discussion, which we'll have in a minute. And I'm going to finish in a minute. But what I want to say is that all of those are useful and I hope we do talk about them, but all of those things have one thing in common that underpins them that I think we also need to think about if we're going to seriously address this question of whether the economic system is capable of doing what it's done for the last couple of hundred years. And what underpins all of these things is this notion of money. What is money? How is it created? And how is it distributed? And this is a topic we could spend a whole lot of time on. But the reason why this is important is that we are regularly told by those who are controlling our economic system and those, the politicians and the economists and the reserve bankers, that the amount of money is critical. The amount of money in circulation is critical. It's critical for two reasons. If there isn't enough of it, then things that otherwise would be useful don't get done. And so we hear about one of the implications of the global financial crisis is banks stop lending. And so people who otherwise had good ideas that might have employed people that might have got more jobs couldn't get access to money because the banks stopped lending. So if there's too little money, useful stuff that could get done doesn't get done. If there's too much money, then you have what we have inflation. You have money chasing a shortage of goods and people bid up the price for the good. So clearly money is important. Now, I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time talking about the role of money, but I do just want to point out that at the same time as people have been asking these questions about jobs and employment, They've been asking these questions about money. And in particular, they've been asking the question whether our current monetary system, which works this way, most people believe that money is created by governments when they print dollar bills and when they mint coins. That's in fact not the case. The amount of money of that kind in circulation is vanishingly small compared to the actual amount of money in circulation. Money is nowadays is little more than entries in a bank account. The way money is created in our economy is when a bank creates a loan. When a banker says to you, here is $100,000 to go and buy that house, that $100,000 didn't exist in the bank when they gave it to you. There is no expectation that the bank has $100,000 in the bank at the time. In fact, we have what's called a fractional reserve system. The bank only has to have 8% of that money in the bank at the time. It can lend that money out. And the reason it can lend that money out is because the expectation is that you'll repay it back, and when you need the money, it'll be there. The ARRA system is based on the assumption that not everybody wants their money at every time, and so the bank can lend it out. So that's in fact how money is created. Money is created when a loan is made. That's been going on for a long time. People have been creating loans all over the place. What's different about the current system, and governments used to do it as well, governments used to lend as well. What's different about this system is that the only time banks will lend money is if they can make a profit on it. That's called the interest rate. And some people argue that on a finite world, you can't keep having infinite money, finite. And some people ask the question whether this banking system, based around a small number of people called bankers, creating money for profit, whether it creates the right amount of money that we need in order to get the economy moving, whether it distributes the money to the appropriate people at the appropriate times, is in fact happening. And they've been asking these questions for a long, long time and questioning whether that should happen. We had as a guest here early this year an ANU economist who's been talking about these questions, and there are all sorts of people who are suggesting that in fact there are other ways of thinking about how money is created and then how money is distributed, which would mean that more money went to the places where it was likely to do the work that was providing for the economic needs of the people who were there. So I reckon, having spent 25 years asking this question, there is enough evidence of what's going on in the world to make it worthwhile saying, can we rely on this current system continuing to operate the way it has for 100 years? And if we can't, what are we going to do about it? What I'm encouraged more about now, 25 years later, than I was in the early 1990s, is there now seem to be many, many more people coming up with solutions, suggestions and options, which mean we could get ourselves out of what otherwise would be a huge mess if we don't get ourselves out of it. I mean, if we can't provide the jobs we need for everybody, we will see what we're seeing in some of the poorer countries in the world, revolutions happening, because people don't get access to what they would like. So I think it's a worthwhile question. I'm encouraged to find that there are increasing answers coming out, and I'm looking forward to at least a bit of a discussion around the table about what you think about all that.